Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Alexis Grinnell, political consultant and columnist at The Nation, will join us to discuss her view that Joe Biden should be our last president and that the United States should move to a parliamentary system.
And Heather Digby Parton will help me run down the biggest news stories of the week. Hey, become a member of this podcast over at ROFpodcast.com. It is your support that helps keep this show going. And don't forget, you can watch the interviews from the Ring of Fire podcast on the Majority Report YouTube channel. Head over to youtube.com/Sam Cedar, S-A-M-S-E-D-E-R. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and, of course, her very popular blog, Hullabaloo. So, Heather, as we speak, the second impeachment of the president or former president, thank goodness, of the United States is taking place. It is obviously the first time we've ever had an impeachment of a president who is no longer sitting president. Or I should say, it's the first time the impeachment came while he was president. This is the first time that we've had a Senate trial to convict him of that impeachment. And it is also the first time that we have a president who has been impeached twice. And, you know, we were just talking before we started to record. And I, you know, maybe you didn't say this explicitly, but I think there is a sense that this is far more intriguing, far more devastating, and far having much more political salience than we might have anticipated a week ago.
I think you're right. I mean, for one thing, let's just give credit where credit is due. I mean, these impeachment managers put together a really masterful case. They are presenting it in the most methodical and understandable way you could possibly imagine. If everybody in the country were watching it, which they are not, but a lot of people are, in fact, more probably than watched the first impeachment because people are at home now. Many people are still at home and the pandemic is still raging and there's probably a lot more attention being paid to it than the first one. And this case is so... The case that they're putting on is so incredibly compelling. It's almost irrefutable as far as I'm concerned. I at the time we're recording this, I haven't heard the president's, defense on this, but it's hard to imagine that they can do anything other than just saying, you can believe us, you can believe your lying eyes, because it's clear what happened. And the case that's been put on is very compelling. And I think you and I, when we were talking about this just before the show, I think both of us have had an experience now of having people who haven't followed this story quite as closely as we have because we have to, or who were just sort of tangentially aware of the timeline and even some of the people in politics that we see on TV who are coming on and going, wow, I had no idea. They just did not know just how, thoroughly the Trump message was incorporated into what happened that day, and the way that they've put this together, it's like people are going, well, how can they possibly not find, the president was responsible? Now, you and I both know that they can because they can do anything they want, and they're shameless. So, we are assuming that they are going to acquit him. I mean, they did gain one more vote for conviction, it appears, with Senator Cassidy, and we don't know for sure that he's going to, but it from his comments and from the vote he took in the first day, he has come over, which makes six Republicans, which, is probably more than any of us expected.
Right.
But nonetheless, it appears that there's at least that many. And as you and I were saying, you said to me, these people are kind of expecting a conviction based upon the case that they are watching being presented. And, I think you and I both know that that's kind of far-fetched. But there may be a few more. It's possible. I don't expect it, but if anyone has a thought for their legacy, their place in history, the idea that, I mean, if they are looking at this for what it is, which is one of the most, it's an historical event that happened on January 6th. This impeachment is an historical event as well, and they are part of it. And they are going to be mentioned in the history books. There's going to be people who will know who they are, you know, well into the future, centuries from now, they'll study it. And, you know, if they have a thought for that, they may be thinking twice about whether or not they want to throw themselves on the pyre once again for Donald Trump and his red hat stormtroopers. I don't know if any of them are capable of doing that. I really don't. But it'll be interesting to see. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I share all those, that sense of what has happened. And I think, you know, it was fascinating how the tone was set so dramatically in that first day when the House managers did an amazing job, and Jamie Raskin was incredibly powerful. The story he told, the story he told of bringing his daughter and I think it's her husband or boyfriend to the House, to the Congress, to see the certification of the election. And the motivation for that being that, you know, they wanted to be able to support him after his son had taken his own life in just the weeks earlier. And that she was so terrified by what had happened when she was there, coincidentally, when this insurrection happened, this attack, that she never wanted to come back to the house again. And the emotion that he expressed during that was incredibly moving. And then the juxtaposition of the legal team for Donald Trump, who did not seem to, well, I mean, in part because, you know, Trump had fired his team before and brought these folks in, but they didn't seem to sort of grasp they didn't seem to grasp anything. I mean, I'm trying to express what I witnessed, particularly from that caster. And it was literally like a guy who had, just realized at 1 a.m. the night before, I got to do some studying for this, wrote out notes and then left his notebook in the car and was waiting for somebody to go get the right notebook. He realized he had the wrong notebook and he was just trying to piece it together. I mean, it was very strange. And I think that set a tone where, hey, the House managers are credible and there may not be a defense for this. And by day one, you had, I think, all of the typical right-wing apparatus saying, okay, well, yes, it was bad what happened in there, but Trump's not responsible. And then by day two, it becomes, or really day three, I guess, it becomes quite evident that, yeah, no, he was responsible. I mean, I think it was Joaquin Castro played a clip of, he showed a tweet that Trump, launched basically as people were amassing in front of the Capitol. And about to, break in there. And he tweeted out about, Mike Pence basically being a traitor and not doing the right thing. And they played video of people literally reading off the tweet to this crowd as they're, we need to go in there, And I don't know how you make the connection any stronger than that, except for reporting that came out, within the days after the attack, that guys like Kevin McCarthy were on the phone to Donald Trump saying, you've got to do something. You've got to do something to help, drop tensions. And Trump's like, no, thanks. Not interested. I mean, why is Kevin McCarthy calling Donald Trump if the argument is now Donald Trump did not have any influence on these people? Right. Like, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you call me? Why wouldn't we call Digby? You know, like, I mean, like, who, you know, why would you call the president unless you think the president's going to fly in on a jetpack and rescue you? No, you call the president because you realize he has sway with these people, that these people are doing it because he pushed them towards it. And that to me seems, I mean, and I agree with you. Like, it's not, although I got to say, you know, we're recording this Thursday. I got to say, like, I'm in the mind of, like, it doesn't seem inconceivable to me that they could get 10 votes. They're never going to get 16 or 17. That's not going to happen. But I could see that, you know, you had those original five, Collins, Murkowski, Romney, Sasse, and Toomey. Toomey, of course, is resigning, it appears, or is in trouble in Pennsylvania. I think, and Sasse is trying to, like, you know, brand himself as the Trump alternative. Romney is probably too. Collins and Murkowski, that's their brand. But I could see, you know, and then Cassidy coming out and making that first vote. I could see Cassidy maybe thinking, like, maybe this is part of my new brand too on some level. And then you could see, like, maybe Portman, right, resigning.
Yeah.
Maybe wants a future in, you know, amongst real normal human beings. And then you're at like seven, and maybe there's a sense of like, hey, wait a second. If we get to 10, we could be a viable, force legislatively and prevent the Democrats down the road. And we'll talk about this from like getting rid of the filibuster, because we now have given like a, you know, a path to some type of like middle ground. I mean, it's not inconceivable to see 10. It's absolutely inconceivable to me to see 16 or 17. So he's not going to get convicted. But there's a price that is being exerted. And that has been, you know, I think probably both our theories about impeachment for some time, that there is a price to be exerted on the Republican Party for being who they are. Really? I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. Like, you know, I want to say supportive of Trump, but it really is who they are. And there is a political price that they are paying. I can't sit here and tell you how many votes they're going to lose in their next election, how much their polling numbers are going to drop, but I can tell you that it's greater than zero. And in any opportunity you have as a political entity to make your opponent pay a political price greater than zero, you take it, in my mind.
Well, that's absolutely true. And I think, I mean, first of all, two things. There's one thing I think that, and the House managers in the presentation have made a lot of out of this, and I think it's important and very strategically smart of them to do it on a purely political level, is that they have emphasized what happened to Mike Pence. And, you know, Pence being, you know, he's just, you know, he was Trump's most loyal soldier. There's nobody more loyal to Donald Trump than Mike Pence has been. And in that last day, the fact that he could not do what he could not do, it was magical thinking to believe that he could have done what Trump wanted him to do. He simply, there was no power for him to do it, which was to reject the Electoral College votes, and Pence knew that. Pence basically sicked that crowd on Mike Pence that day, and we watched footage of Mike Pence being hustled out of the building within just, you know, like half a hallway from the rioters who were in there, from the insurrectionists who were out there shouting, "Hang Mike Pence." And what we found out this week was that, you know, there was a bit of a brouhaha on the second day in which Mike Lee, at the end of the day, you know, objected to his words being used in one of the presentations. And what that had to do with was a phone calls that were made during the insurrection to they were trying to, both Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump were trying to call Tommy Tuberville, the new senator from Alabama, to try to leverage the insurrection into getting him to push to delay the Electoral College vote, not come back and do it to push through, maybe go the next day or go whatever, because supposedly they had new information, which of course was nonsense. I mean, Trump at that point was just trying to delay as long as he could. And they were doing this during the insurrection, and they made this call to Mike Lee. He said he was misrepresented. The press says, no, he wasn't misrepresented, et cetera, et cetera. But the point of it being is that Tommy Tuberville came out and gave a comment on Wednesday night saying, I can't talk right now. They've just removed, when Donald Trump called him, they've just removed Mike Pence from the chamber. And what that did was tag the timing of when Trump made that call. Tommy Tuberville said that he had said that specifically. And when you looked at the timeline, what you realized was that the tweet that Trump sent saying Mike Pence has betrayed us came after that call to Tommy Tuberville. So he knew that Tuberville, Trump knew when he sent that that tweet that you know, that Pence had, you know, that Pence was in danger, and he sent it anyway. I mean, it's almost as if he was telling people, go find him.
Yep.
He's out of the chamber. He's gone. Go get him. And that was the message that his people took. So that's a pretty scary thing that they, you know, I mean, I think that that's maybe one of the most chilling things that we found out in the impeachment is what they did. And the other thing about this is exactly what you just said, which is that the political price to be paid, you know, there are people making bets all over the place right now about 2024. All of the presidential hopefuls, and there are a whole bunch of them in that group, from Marco Rubio, Ben Sasse, Liz Cheney over in the House. You've got, you know, I don't know, Jim Jordan, who knows, but it's going to be a big crowd, right? And Donald Trump hovers over this whole thing, you know, like this ghostly presence that is, you know, basically kind of dictating what the field is going to be and where they're going to be, who they're going to be. And it reminds me of 2002 when they took that Iraq war vote and all the Democratic presidential hopefuls took that vote for the Iraq war because they thought that that was what they needed to do in order to win the presidency in either 2004, and I don't think they were looking forward to 2008, but that vote dogged them for years.
Yep.
They paid a tremendous price. All of them did. And they had, you know, whether it was John Kerry saying I was for it before I was against it, or Hillary Clinton and her vote. And in fact, I think we all know that Barack Obama largely got credibility for the fact that he didn't make that vote. And by the way, when you go back to the early 90s in the first Gulf War, Bill Clinton won. Because he wasn't in the Congress at the time, and that whole argument around that war vote didn't hit him because he wasn't in the Congress. So, you know, these things, when they're looking ahead and they're trying to make a decision, trying to finesse this decision about should I support Donald Trump, shouldn't I, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know what? My feeling is, watching this stuff my whole life in politics and coming down to it, when you're dealing with these huge issues, and this insurrection was a huge, huge historic event, and it says everything about where you are, where you're positioning yourself in our democracy, if you have to just go on personal integrity. If you're making a political decision here and, you know, trying to, you know, worm your way through it or work your way around it for what you perceive as a political advantage in the future, huge mistake. And I think that every one of these guys who were just, you know, basically, well, got to appease Donald Trump and his red-hatted, you know, thugs, I think that they are looking down the road. I mean, I don't know how it's going to go. I mean, maybe it's the other people who are going to pay a price.
Right.
But at this point, it sure looks to me like it's chancy to get too fine with this and try and appease, you know, Trump and his people in this moment, because this could really come back to bite them. And some of them clearly don't want to. Yeah, some of them are true believers. I mean, you know, Rand
right.
Paul, you know, obviously he doesn't, whatever. But, you know, there are others who are obviously trying to work their way through this in some way, and it's a huge mistake. It never seems to work out for people when they do that.
I mean, I think there's some truth to that, you know, on the presidential level. But the problem is, I think a lot of these senators are just like, I'm just going to be a senator, and this is the way that I'm going to stop any future primary. And I think that is, the the proper calculation. You know, a lot of these are, you know, just full on red staters. They'll never, you know, the worry about a primary is more relevant to them in the final analysis. But I do think that, yes, as a general election, you know, I don't know. I mean, I've said this before, right? Where I thought like the Republican Party is cooked.
Yeah, me too.
And so I'm very hesitant to say that now. Although, you know, I think ultimately the shape of the Republican Party in terms of their health is really going to be a function of just how aggressive the Democrats get, and we'll pivot to that in just a moment. I would say how aggressive they get within these next, really, you know, 12 months. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But this is, I think, going to be a big deal, right? And the interesting thing here, too, is I think, you know, I got a text from a buddy of mine who, you know, follows politics, but not that closely. And the text was, let me just read it, because I was really surprised about it. And I haven't watched, you know, the coverage of the impeachment. I've watched like, you know, big chunks of the impeachment. I haven't watched the coverage of it. And he texted me, this was Wednesday night. And he said, stunning that the national news media is just now realizing how close we came to a slaughter. And it hadn't even occurred to me, because to be honest, like, I don't watch probably as much national news as most people. That beat in terms of like critiquing media seems less relevant to me these days because of the nature of our media landscape. But from the perspective of a normie, of a civilian, he was really taken aback by how sort of shocked, and I imagine he's talking about MSNBC or CNN for that matter, or ABC or NBC. And the interesting thing about that is, and we have talked about this a million times, there is such a dramatic compulsion on behalf of MSNBC, of CNN, of ABC, of, you know, CBS, of all of these major media outlets to want to believe, and I think this is true certainly of the Democratic leadership, to want to believe that these are good people, the Republican Party, but they're being held hostage, or they're afraid of like what Donald Trump is going to do. I mean, this is how people wrote off, you know, John Boehner saying like, I'm not going to, you know, tell my caucus that they can't, you know, pass a law saying that you can't be from Kenya to be president or whatever that law, you know, like this has always been the story, right? And we see this, and we've talked about this on the show, like, you know, Chris Coons going on TV going like, well, behind the scenes, a couple of the Republican senators, you know, have told me that they accept that Joe Biden's the president. Or, you know, I imagine we're going to start hearing stories of like, I really wanted to vote against, you know, I talked to my colleagues across the aisle and they really want to vote against Donald Trump, but they're afraid. Well, I feel like this is going to be so explicit. And, yeah, you know, it's like, you're now afraid of a private citizen? Excuse me, like what? Like this is going to be a moment, I think, where, and it's not going to be wholesale. I'm done with like believing that there can be wholesale changes, frankly. But you're going to lose a couple of members of the media from that media caucus that believes like Republicans are normal. It's just that they're they have a fever. You know what I mean? And that mentality, I think, is going to become less and less prevalent. And that is going to, I think, because the Democrats are so beholden, particularly these older Democrats, I'm talking leaders and electeds, are so beholden to that conventional wisdom that they perceive to be so sacrosanct, that as that sort of degrades and disintegrates slightly, you're going to see more boldness from Democrats. That's my, you know, theory slash aspirational theory. but, you know, but I think it's possible. I think it's possible. Every little bit helps, right?
I do too. This has been a long evolution. You and I have been following this for many, many years, pushing it. I mean, if you and I were to go back and look at some of the stuff we wrote and said 15 years ago, it would have been impossible to believe that Democrats would do what they've done recently, even this impeachment. I would have just thought, oh, they're going to say we can't look backwards. We got to look forwards. We've got too much work to do. Let's just let this go, and maybe we'll have a committee look at it or whatever. But that they would not have done this. And I think, I mean, some of it is the realization of what's happened to the Republicans is just obvious. I mean, Donald Trump being elected alone was a wake-up call to a lot of people, I think, who had just sort of bought into that notion that you just were discussing. But it's been a long time coming. I mean, it really took a lot of effort on the part of progressives and progressive media and people just, you know, relentlessly sort of going, look, 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 and they're still doing it. You still got people like Jay Rosen and Eric Bullard and Dan Frumkin and other media critics who are out there, you know, kind of still, you know, pushing the mainstream media and people like us pushing the Democrats. And you know, I mean, this is part of the process. But I do feel like there is some chance that we're going to see that it's a chance that we've turned the corner here, that there's a point now where, I mean, how do you ignore the fact that Donald Trump incited a riot and they went and assaulted, they sacked the United States Capitol during a joint session of Congress to overturn an election. I mean, every time I think about that, I'm just going, it's like, you know, astonishing. It's beyond astonishing that they actually did that, but they did. And that was just the culmination of years and years and years of radicalization that we saw coming from, you know, I mean, I'm just reading a thing about, you know, Rush Limbaugh apparently is in his last days. He's got stage 4 lung cancer. He hasn't been showing up, and apparently he's very, very ill, and, you know, the end is nigh. And there was a sort of a retrospective on his contribution to our politics, and he started in 1988. And this has been going on since then. That radicalization, there's a straight line coming right out of that period. And so here we are, and the Democrats, it took them way, way, way too long to get there, you know, to wake up to what was happening. And it took, you know, that the near destruction of our government to make that happen. But I do kind of feel like there, and of course, you know, the influx of younger people makes a huge difference.
I think three major things that support your thesis is one is that we're also seeing a generational change, and not just a change in generation, but a generation now that is competitive in sheer numbers to the baby boomer generation that Rush Limbaugh and the Clintons represented. Okay. And, you know, because the millennials are the same size physically, I mean, not physically, in terms of sheer numbers, I should say. In fact, a little bit bigger than the baby boomers. And so we live in a capitalist society, and so much is about, you know, sort of consumption and their experience is being played out in our politics and our, you know, society far more so than let's say Gen X because of their sheer numbers, and mm-hmm. and I think they have grown up with a different Republican Party and a different sort of like perspective on this stuff. I would also say that like what is also contributing to that is, like you say, is the election of Donald Trump is a sort of sign of like, hey, really hard to ignore what's going on with the Republican Party. And then the other thing I think that's going to add to this, that I think, you know, again, it's like a bunch of straws on a camel's back, right? Is COVID. And when you know, the era that you're describing is the era of, is really Reagan's era of, the scariest words you can hear is "I'm from the government. Right. I'm here to help." And that was echoed by Bill Clinton with, like, you know, the era of big government is over. But there's nothing like a pandemic to remind everybody that, like, hey, wait a second. Actually, the reality is that there are major, major issues in our society that can only be dealt by a societal wide response.
Right.
And that, I think those things combined, I think could, I have a feeling we're going to get there eventually. It's just, I don't know if you or I will, but you and I could end up seeing this kind of change, and it would be a function, I think, of, like, COVID and the potential for response to COVID that the Democrats have the opportunity to do that could change, really fundamentally change the perspective on government, which is going to fundamentally change how each party sees their roles in some way.
I don't think there's any doubt. I mean, I think that realization, and for a lot of young people, that's not a realization, right? They may have grown up in that sort of political cultural milieu of the era of big government is over, but it wasn't explicit the way it was in the 80s and 90s. By the time the 2000s came along, we had a bunch of different factors that were coming in there. I mean, the first part of the new century was just taken up with 9/11 and Iraq, right? I mean, that was the overwhelming thing, and you weren't really hearing a lot about, you know, big government being the problem. It was there, and they were talking about deficits and cutting Social Security and what have you, but it wasn't the overweening kind of issue that it had been in the previous decade and the one before. And then, of course, you know, once the financial crisis came in, I think everybody suddenly, you know, started thinking a little bit more about things like austerity and what have you. And so the younger generation has grown up in a different era with a different kind of cultural take on that, and a good one, because you had come along Occupy Wall Street, you had Bernie Sanders and his campaign. You know, there's been this progressive / populist new sort of, you know, faction growing in power and influence on the left and in the Democratic Party itself, and that makes a big difference. And at the same time, we're seeing this assault on democracy coming from the right, and it's now become so explicit that it's not ignorable. I mean, I'm really pleased. I can't tell you how pleased I am to see that the left and the progressive, you know, faction that I identify with is taking that part of it as seriously as the economic part of it, because, you know, it's very tempting to just get into economic determinism and decide that that's the only issue, that's what economic determinism is, but right. You know, I mean, the idea that everything, you know, falls under that rubric, when in fact, in my view anyway, and it appears that others are seeing that as well, that this is there are other dimensions to our political culture that have to be dealt with. And when there's an explicit assault on democracy, on the government, on, right-wing fascism sort of rising, that demands attention as well. And I'm really pleased to see the new left-wing, political voices taking up that banner along with the economic banner. You know, I mean, this is it has to be. You can't have one without the other, in my view. Yeah, they're both. One doesn't work without the other one working.
I mean, let's just pivot briefly to, like, you know, we keep sort of like setting this up of, like, there is a unique opportunity here, and you know, some of this may be inevitable, but I doubt it, right? Like, I don't think that there's sort of like, I never think these things are inevitable, but there is an opportunity. And, you know, I think it starts with this COVID relief bill, for the Democrats. I mean, what's interesting about what this opportunity is it's not only an opportunity for them to actually, like, sort of begin to provide, what Democrats sort of built their reputation on back during the New Deal. It's not just an opportunity to provide some of that. We're not talking about anything particularly like dramatic in that respect. But there is also, like, I feel like every time they put their foot in the water and they find, like, it's not as cold as we thought it was, it emboldens them a little bit more, right? And so we're going to see them go to reconciliation. That seems to be a foregone conclusion now, to pass this COVID relief bill. And the $1,400 check threshold, the Democrats in the House passed it with the same threshold as we saw from the last check. I'm not convinced that some of that talk about thresholds and whatnot wasn't sort of theater to change the topic from, like, why isn't it $2,000? I mean, it really from a political perspective, without a doubt, it should have been $2,000, right? Like, if you're up there having to explain, well, it's $2,000 if you add the $600 from before, that may be technically true, but I mean, come on. And the cost of it would have been only something like $45 billion based upon, I think, something that David Dayen wrote. There was research that basically said, like, you know, some of this is going to be clawed back because of taxes and whatnot. I mean, I don't know what the compulsion is of Democrats to sort of negotiate against themselves. You know, if you can do 1,400, you can do 2,000. Like, it just seems a no-brainer. You've got two senators from Georgia begging you to do that. I don't know why you don't just do it. But be that as it may, they're going to pass this under reconciliation. The big test is going to be, in my perspective, what they do with the $15 minimum wage. It has come out of the House, and no one denies that. Well, let's put it this way. It got a bad score from the office, from this Congressional Budget Office, you know, that it's going to cost the $64 billion on the deficit over the course of 10 years, which is really nothing. You know, we're talking $6 billion a year. I mean, we're talking about a $1.9 trillion bill they're going to pass. It supposedly is going to cost 1.4 million jobs over the course of 10 years. That's built on faulty research. But even if we were to stipulate that's the case, it is also going to, you know, take 1 million people out of poverty, extreme poverty. It's going to take millions of others, out of, you know, off of other programs and give them a good life. Part of the job loss is going to be a function of, like, people are going to be like, I don't have to work three jobs anymore. I only have to work two. Or I have to work one to be able to afford to live. Like, that's not a bad reason to lose jobs in my mind. And theoretically, like, the jobs don't go away. Maybe other people take those jobs. But putting that aside, the real question is, I mean, Joe Biden still wants to do it, right? I mean, ostensibly. The real question is, are they going to put, you know, is the parliamentarian now going to be able to say it affects the budget because of the deficit that it supposedly has? There's no studies out there that show that it doesn't affect the budget. There's only studies that show that it affects the budget, you know, in terms of a deficit or in terms of a surplus, in terms of, you know, net what it adds, not necessarily creating a surplus, but a net positive to the ledger. But nevertheless, to satisfy the Byrd rule, all you need to do is show that it affects the government budget, you know, for better or for worse. It doesn't matter. And if the parliament,
look at the tax cut bill that they did, that the Republicans did,
right,
that created deficits. I mean, there was
right, and they did it through reconciliation.
Exactly.
And now the parliamentarian could theoretically rule that that's not the case. It's not legit. But everybody knows, and nobody disputes, that Kamala Harris can say, I overrule your interpretation. Kamala Harris could say, my interpretation, you know, is that it does and that it's okay under the Byrd rule, and we're going to vote for it on reconciliation. And that seems to me to be because it involves process and it involves, like, material benefit for people and a promise that they made. And it's like coming out the gate, like, we're not going to mess around with this stuff. And I think that if they do that, they're going to find, like, hey, wait a second. the American public is not outraged that Kamala Harris overruled the parliamentarian on this point of order. And they're just happy that the minimum wage is raised. Oh, it's okay. And Chuck Todd's not, you know, tongue lashing us or whatever it is, you know. And I think that's what opens the door for them to come back with a fix for the voting rights bill. And then they get rid of the filibuster. And then we are off to the races, it seems to me.
Well, you know, you could be right. I mean, I know that that this argument is taking place as to whether or not they should have Harris overrule the parliamentarian on this. And they're going back and forth on that. I have no idea where it's going to come out. But, you know, I think I'm with you. I think that this is, you know, this is the time for bold action. And if you want to take a big chance and use an unusual process to pass something, in light of the fact that, you know, in when this happens, the Senate will have just, you know, let Donald Trump off from you know, actually, you know, inciting an insurrection to overturn the election. Their credibility will be at a low ebb for anything they're talking about, you know, about being patriots or whatever. It's kind of like, yeah, talk to the hand, right? So it's a good time to push the envelope. I mean, we're in a crisis. There's, you know, this is the moment when you do it. And in a way, you know, I mean, look, this has worked out for Democrats in the past in the long run. I mean, they're always progress is one of those things. You got to take a leap of faith sometimes. And then you're going to have to pay a little bit when they go, you know, two steps forward, one step back, which is what happened with Obamacare. But the fact is that, you know, it's the time. And the greatest argument they have for it is that the people of Florida who voted for Donald Trump also voted for $15 minimum wage, you know, this in November. So, you know, this is not something that's beyond the pale and that, you know, Republicans are all aghast and, oh, it's going to kill us, et cetera, et cetera. They're voting for this around the country, and they've got plenty of data to back it up and blah, blah, blah. Not that anybody cares about that. But the fact is that now's the time to do it. But I don't know if they will. I don't know if they're going to throw this one aside, you know, put everything else into reconciliation, leave this one aside so they can say, hey, you know, we're going to come back and we're observing the Senate rules and we're not being, you know, we're not breaking any norms or whatever, you know. I don't know. It's entirely possible that they will use that one issue as their sort of bait, you know, to say, you know, we're not that radical. Don't worry. So we'll have to see. And it will tell us something, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think it will tell us something, but I think it will also, I think it has the opportunity to sort of open the door for something very,
absolutely,
dramatic may not be the right word, but usher in a really a new era. Not necessarily a fully satisfying one, but one that will not be so deeply frustrating.
Wow. That just warms my heart. This is going to be the era of not so deeply frustrating.
No, it has the potential.
It
has the potential. I'll take it too. On that note, I'm glad we could get to a very optimistic note, Heather.
Absolutely. I feel so much better now.
Yes. Well, I mean, this is a question that's going to be resolved in the next 4 weeks.
Absolutely.
So, because we've got unemployment insurance running out the second week of March. And the Democrats need to get this done before then. So we're going to know the answer to this, I think, very, very significant question relatively soon. And it's pretty rare where you get these sort of like this sort of series of rolling, you know, I guess I want to say tea leaves, but I think it's a little bit more explicit than tea leaves. I'm not sure what it is, but but it's these signs and signals and indicators and sort of like milestones. We are certainly living in interesting times. Not sure I'm sold on that it's good to live in those type of times, but it is what it is. Heather,
we don't have a choice.
Heather, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Heather Parton is a weekly contributor to Ring of Fire Radio. You can find her writings over at Salon.com and the popular blog Hullabaloo. Now I'm going to hand the show over to our new Ring of Fire co-host. I almost can't say that anymore. Emma Vigeland.
Thanks, Sam. Hello, everyone. I am here with Alexis Grinnell. She is a political consultant and a columnist whose work has appeared in The Washington Post, New York Daily News, Daily Beast, and most recently in The Nation, where she wrote a fascinating article called 46 and Done, Why Joe Biden Should Be Our Last President. How are you, Alexis?
I'm good, and thank you for having me. I want to also add that I'm officially a columnist at The Nation, so this is my new home.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The Nation does amazing work, so I look forward to reading more of your work there. So, provocative title. Let's just start there. Why do you believe that Joe Biden should be our last president?
So nothing against Joe Biden. It's not personal, but I have long been an admirer of parliamentary systems. I find myself gazing across the ocean or just north to Canada, hoping for a semblance of the functionality that you get with a parliamentary system of government, because presidential systems, aside from the United States, are just statistically less functional. And there's no rational reason to continue with it. And again, no disrespect to Biden, but it's such a rare experience to have a quote unquote unified government like we have right now, unified for whatever that means in 2021. But, you know, the midterm elections are a gamble, and historically the, you know, unified government doesn't last. And then we'll just be back in this sort of brutal steel cage death match, which has been, you know, a downward spiral for the last 20 years.
Certainly. And there have been many instances of the right also taking hold of having a supermajority controlling both chambers and the presidency, which I think that's disastrous from my perspective. But even the fact that we have a supermajority now, it's rare. I mean, last time we had it under Obama in his first 2 years, and the rest of the time, it's just complete gridlock. So I really liked that you touched on it. And also just to touch on the Senate as well. Now that there's 50 Democratic senators and 50 Republican senators, the statistic that blows my mind is that those 50 Democratic senators represent 41 million more people. Can you talk about how that kind of imbalance in a supposed democracy, or I guess a republic, plays into your thesis here?
Yeah, well, so I didn't even tackle the Senate and the sort of basic absurdity of it. I mean, the anti-democratic filibuster aside, because it doesn't matter that there are 50 Democratic senators, they kind of aren't governing like that because they need 60 to get anything done. So what kind of situation is that? The Senate is just a bizarre body, right? So it's not about proportional representation. It's sort of about, you know, kind of check in a box. It's absurd in Wyoming, where there's, you know, literally two senators to one representative in the House. So, I mean, that's just like a totally different column. It played into my thesis in that I'm like, wow, American democracy is so screwed. But I'm just going to tackle the presidency for now. In a parliamentary system, though, of course, you have a very different system of representation. And you have factionalism, which we have here, but you have like functional factionalism because you have to coalition governments. And that means that like everybody's a little unhappy and also a little happy most of the time. So we're playing a game of averages here. And I feel like given the age of extremes we've been living in, I would really settle for just some average functionality.
Yeah, well, I totally understand that. You did mention the term factionalism, which was made famous by the founders, the framers, James Madison, and the Federalist Papers, who you quote in your piece. Oftentimes, organizations like the Heritage Foundation will use these pieces to argue why, even though they are in the minority in terms of representation, even though they're in the minority in terms of ideas, they deserve an equal voice because of the tyranny of the majority. How does that dynamic play in?
I believe they deserve a voice, but that's kind of, you know, in a parliamentary system, you get a voice if you get somebody elected, and then, you know, you have a part. My argument is also we just need more parties, which is part of a parliamentary system, so that everybody can have a home, so that Republicans aren't captive to, frankly, Nazis on their right. And there are Nazi parties in other countries. Like, that's a thing. You can just openly identify as a Nazi and stop pretending to be some sort of like free speech, small government Republican. That's just, I'd rather know who you are and how you vote that way, rather than you trying to like make Congress with somebody who, you know, for like, I think most, like, it's abhorrent in its own way, but somebody who's just like a Rob Portman, who's like, I'm not here actually to, you know, actively support white supremacy. I'm just trying to like keep taxes low and maybe just control women's bodies and that, just like basic.
And enrich my donors on the side. Yeah.
Sure. Like protect corporate America, control women's bodies, just like a little bit of like average Republican stuff. Like the Heritage Foundation guys should have a party, right? They can go party with those guys rather than these weird big tents, because we're not doing well with a big tent. And same thing on the left, right?
Like, I was about to say. I mean, that's, I think, the dream for a lot of folks on the left, because not to cut you off, but there's I'm going to ask you to expand on this, because in terms of ideology, the Nazis and the Mitt Romneys, they all, the moneyed interests, they'll get the same thing with either of them, basically, which is deregulation, tax cuts, et cetera. But there's a real ideological split on the left that is divided alongside power and moneyed interests, and it makes it even more difficult for the real left to exert their power and flex their muscle in the Democratic Party. So what would that mean for leftists if your vision were to play out?
Sure. Well, so I think, you know, I use the example of Germany, right, where the Green Party, which has been around for ages and is a joke in the United States, but is like a real thing in Germany and has actually amassed significant power, like a significant representation in the Bundestag at this point. But in order for them to do anything, they have to kind of caucus and coalition with the ruling party. And so they're making that compromise to get some stuff done. But the only reason they've been able to get to this point is because they've actively been, you know, gaining credibility. And I think at least in the American left, you know, the left has absolutely pushed the Democratic Party and the center. The center has moved. But I guess what I'm saying is I'm not opposed to centrist Democrats existing with centrist Republicans and leftists being able to just be lefties. So, you know, and I write this in the piece, like, this, it's not a bid for ideological purity, because again, like the Greens in Germany, like they're making compromises to advance an agenda here, but it just makes more sense for everyone to sort of live in the correct home and then try to work out governing together. I'm not going for perfect here. Again, I'm just hoping for functional, because right now we just don't have that. And I feel like what happens to us on the left is we get a little bit caught up in like, who's a real progressive or who's a real Democrat and who's got, you know, really working people in mind. And it's like, okay, not everyone does actually. And we should just acknowledge that and be able to like move forward.
Yeah, I totally get that. What do you say to say this just counterexample sticks out in my mind? The way Labour has exiled Jeremy Corbyn, for example, and has in their own way tried to stifle leftist growth in their party. And the Tories are fairly far right in their own right. But obviously the UK is a very specific example. How does that, the way things have worked, I guess, over the past two decades, I mean, with neoliberalism being on the rise since Margaret Thatcher, how do you square those things?
So the UK example, I think, you know, the UK is a little funky in this.
Right. I mean, that's my caveat as well.
Like the UK throws things off a little bit, just, and to be clear, you know, for anyone watching, you know, if you're thinking also like, what about France? So France is technically a semi-presidential system. It's not categorized as a parliamentary democracy. And I'm not even really going to consider Italy in this equation. Italy is a hot mess on so many levels. So nothing, there are always going to be weird exceptions. And again, my argument is not for a perfect system. My argument is for a functional system. And I think at least in the UK, with the example of the Labour Party and Corbyn, and I have issues there because I think Corbyn, and this is a mistake that gets made on the American left too, like sort of tripped over his own shoes in a way he absolutely didn't have to. And it was, I don't actually think he's a particularly good leader. And I think Labour made a decision that they wanted to have better leadership. So that aside, I guess, you know, I look at the, like,
I can see that argument. Yeah.
Yeah. But like right now here, look at Chuck Schumer. The senior senator for New York, the majority leader in the Senate now, Chuck Schumer is out there posting selfies and doing events with AOC, with every like newly elected or recently elected woman of color in the New York State Legislature who's a sort of rising star in some way. That man is busy planting his flag because he sees which way the wind blows. That's actually what I consider functional, right? This is great. He's like, okay, this is where my power base is. Let me take
care of it. And fear of a primary as well.
Fear of a primary, but that's going to be my next piece. I really don't think Chuck Schumer should be our target.
I agree. But I love the idea that he's afraid of it.
Yes. And that is everyone should be though. Like yeah. That should be a natural state of being an elected official. You should fear primaries because that means we're living in a like competitive democracy in the same way that like, we want competitive marketplaces. We want competitive politics. Nobody should just be like sitting pretty. So, you know, Schumer, I see like making those moves, trying to like get his coalition together the same way Nancy Pelosi did, you know, when AOC was elected. And she was like, hold on, I better do a Rolling Stone cover shoot with Ilhan, AOC and Rashida pronto. And that was smart. And she has been running she's sort of your modern day Lyndon Johnson, master of the house.
Right. Well, yeah. And an ability to kind of throw breadcrumbs out to specific factions when she knows she needs to. So in your piece, this was really interesting to me. You cite a 1989 study that found that parliamentary systems were three times more likely than presidential ones to have success. And then this was based on coups, basically, right? Or an overthrow. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So it's actually a 1993 study analyzing the success of democracies over the 1979-1980 time period.
Yes.
It's a lot of numbers. The study looked at 93 countries in that frame, and it was basically countries that post-World War II had sort of reconstituted themselves as democracies or had emerged as democracies. And just, you know, it's statistically and empirically, the data doesn't lie. Parliamentary democracies are more stable. Presidential systems are subject to military coup. It's easier to topple when you've got a winner take all system. And the funny thing is, like, parliamentary systems are like full of churn, right? We, you know, it's actually pretty unusual to have somebody like Angela Merkel, or I mean, with the UK has also had long-serving prime ministers, but also a lot of churn. Angela Merkel's about to, she says she's not going to run again. 12 years of chancellor is enough. Margaret Thatcher was another 12-year long hauler. But typically we have more churn in parliamentary systems, and that's a good thing. And it's both more dynamic and stable in a way that winner-take-all systems aren't. It's kind of got like an interesting conflict there that I find just fascinating.
Yeah, no, that is fascinating. It's almost symbiotic as opposed to combative, or, you know, a lot of times I think we conflate what is actually factionalism, like you cited, with bipartisanship with partisanship. I should know that as someone who talks about politics, but it just escaped my brain for a second. That's not what we're not experiencing partisanship right now. We're experiencing factions and just complete gridlock, which you do touch on. So my other question to you then is, ranked choice voting is often seen as a, you got excited. Ranked choice voting is often seen as a way to ease some of these issues with factionalism and with a winner take all system in the US. Can you talk about your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So I'm a big fan. And in Australia, which is a parliamentary system, they have ranked choice as well. It's called preferential voting in Australia, which is probably just, you know, I've seen lots of very funny Aussie political commercials to explaining ranked choice voting, which is hilarious. They have just like the best, most acerbic humor in Australia. But, you know, with RCV, you always have a consensus candidate, right? No matter what, like whoever wins has to win with a majority. And that person is, you know, the person who gets the most votes, regardless of, you know, one, two, and maybe three votes. So in like San Francisco, Ed Lee and London Breed were the number two picks, the most popular number two pick. They weren't the, you know, the person who squeaked by with like just a plurality of the vote. They had that kind of consensus. And that's actually how democracy is supposed to function. So whether or not you take an ideological analysis that says, well, that means that person's going to be more watered down and less progressive maybe, or whatever, it's like, fine, then that's the work of organizers, is to organize the politics around the mayor. The work of democracy is to elect representatives who represent the people. And ranked choice voting, it's the most representative way to elect people because you're getting 50%+ of the vote. That's just basic. So you, yeah. That's like how it's supposed to work.
Well, my final question to you on this would be, we just experienced a cult of personality that emboldened somebody to take a bulldozer to much of what people thought were sacrosanct institutions. Obviously, you are advocating for a more, a very peaceful overhaul of those institutions. But it comes to mind the fact that there was this cult of personality because of the nature of a winner-take-all system. Do you think that the fact that it's so the winner-take-all nature of it emboldened that kind of following of one guy, the ability of one egomaniac, of somebody who has this charismatic force to kind of push a party in his own specific direction and leading it to disastrous results? Do you see that kind of playing into what you're talking about?
So I, for sure. And I think it's really a function of the fact that we elect presidents directly, right? By popular vote. I mean,
exactly. They have to be this, you know, person who's on TV all the time, or who's, you know, the center of everything. Right.
And it's different in a parliamentary system, right? The prime minister is the prime minister. He or she is the number one person of the ministers. So
yes,
you're elected by your colleagues. And, you know, by the way, the thing that felled Margaret Thatcher was a vote of no confidence by her colleagues, by her own party. They were like, nah, we're done. Like, and that's, she didn't, like, that's how she stopped being prime minister. I think that lightness of being, the lack of cults of personality, and I mean, you know, I'll credit AOC, who said this herself, she doesn't want to be a charismatic leader. She doesn't want to be this sort of star, because it's not healthy for how we think about our politics. We actually don't want star-making systems. We're talking about a representative system that's supposed to sort of like meet the needs of the masses. And when you, it's so true, like the problem of direct democracy and electing a president means that you have, like, especially in the media age, you just have to have this like level of like nonstop television and Twitter and whatever.
Yeah.
A prime minister, it's just like, if your colleagues are like, ugh, you're terrible, you could be out. Theresa May was like prime minister for, you know, a hot second, sadly overthrown because I think Boris Johnson is worse. But look, that's, she wasn't like going to stay there forever. And my thought, honestly, when Johnson was elected, I was like, you know what, at least it's a parliamentary system and he's unlikely to be there a long time.
Yeah. And I also just think it gives cover to those strong personalities who can basically, we saw Trump do this, and even Obama to a certain extent, deflect from critique by just being charming, like being oneself. And it's a popularity contest in a way that is less reflective of, or held it's so separate from their peers and colleagues that Obama, Trump, you know, Bill Clinton, Bush doing an entirely different brand of politics than the politics of Congress, if that makes sense to you. Yeah. But that's just really my final thought on the matter, because you've sparked so many interesting thoughts in me based on your piece. So I encourage everybody to check it out. 46 and Done, Why Joe Biden Should Be Our Last President. Alexis Grinnell, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you.
And that's it for another week of Ring of Fire Radio. Are you still subscribed to the free show? Well, head over to rofpodcast.com and support this show by becoming a member. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm, my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day and featuring an in-depth interview like two or three times a week, ladies and gentlemen. For Emma Vigeland, Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio.